Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Nina Pantic, joined in this episode by Irina Falcone, my co-host.
Hey guys, how's it going?
And our special guest, Rajiv Ram. Rajiv, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
All right, let's get things started with one of our favorite questions these days. What is your quarantine life like? Where are you? What do the days look like?
Yeah, it's pretty different, I must say, from coming from someone who's played tennis, as you guys know, for a long time, you know, where we're used to traveling weekly. To be sitting in one place for a couple of months is a bit strange, but lucky to be in Northern California, where the weather is really nice. So I try to get outside most days doing something, you know, 4 or 5 days a week of different fitness stuff. And then, yeah, even on the other days, bike rides, walks, you know, whatever it may be, just to sort of, you know, be outside as much as I can, because it's nice to do that. But it's definitely different.
Is California your home base? Has it been for a while?
Yeah, so I'm from Indianapolis, which is where my wife and I spend a fair bit of time there. But we also have a house in Northern California. Both of our parents live in Indiana still. So we go there a bit, but we spend a lot of time here. And sort of, yeah, the quarantine sort of basically started the day before I was supposed to leave for Indian Wells, which was, you know, we were out here. I was packed, suitcases were packed. They're actually still packed, funnily enough. And then this whole thing started. So then we've been out here since then.
All right. So you were on the ATP Council before, Regina. I know. I just wanted to know if maybe you have some intel into when things might come back or which tournaments are going to be canceled next or any kind of inside info.
Yeah, no, not really. I basically hear things when everybody else hears them. We get, you know, mass emails saying, okay, this, you know, the tour is canceled up until this date. And the last one I think was, you know, just the cancellation of Wimbledon and the whole grass court season and all that. I learned about the French Open moving their date on social media, which maybe is what most people learn about it on. I have no idea. But no, to be honest, it's just, you know, we kind of, for me at least, I just wait to see when the next message comes to see, at this point, you know, how much longer the tour is going to be officially canceled. But I think everyone is feeling like it's, you know, it's going to be hard to play even in the middle of July at this point.
Have you been hitting like at all? I know I've spoken to a few players and I know some of the top 10 girls and they just haven't hit a ball since, you know, this whole thing started. And I'm just curious, you know, have you even like done fitness? Like, how are you like keeping in shape?
Yeah, so tennis is obviously tough. I haven't played too much. There's one guy I know with a private court that, yeah, I don't even know if I'm supposed to be doing it or not, but, you know, the couple of times I've been up there to hit some balls. But fitness, I have a few things at home. Like I said, the weather is really nice, and I have some room in the back of the house here that, you know, I can do some things. So it's been a bit makeshift, let's say. I have a trainer that I got to know before this started. She actually has some equipment of her own. So like we have a deal that we do where she actually brings it over some of the days. I clean it, I use it, bring it back to her car. She like stays 6 feet away from me the whole time, like, you know, tells me what to do, you know, runs me through a program. I bring it back to her car. She cleans it, puts it back in the car and we go from there. But I'm not even sure, you know, we try to be as safe as possible, but that's really it for all that. You know, I have a bike here that an actual bike that has never gotten more use. I try to be on it a couple times a week, you know, riding around, but yeah, that's pretty much it. I feel like, you know, a lot of the other restrictions are going to loosen up well before we actually start playing tennis again. So I'm not really worried about, you know, I think we'll all have plenty of time to practice and all that before we actually start competing again.
I was actually talking with Jamie about this yesterday about how many different things are going to change once we go back on court. Cause I'm sure you've heard that there's actual like tournament play that's happening here in Saddlebrook. There's an event, I think, happening in California and Germany. There's a few spots that are conducting almost like a tennis experiment. And, you know, one of the things that she told me was that the balls actually have initials on them. and only you can only use the balls, and you can only serve with the balls that have your initials on them. And we were discussing, you know, when we actually get back on tour, you know, is there going to be a air high five? Like, are you going to shake hands? Like, is there going to be any interaction whatsoever? Like, when it's new balls, how are you going to get those balls? Like, do you have to get them yourself? Like, there's just going to be so many different changes.
Yeah, I think that's just in every walk of life, to be honest. It's not just tennis. I mean, like, maybe it's going to become normal for people to wear masks in grocery stores if they have even the slightest bit of a cold or a cough or something like that, or, you know, having meetings like this instead of actually having meetings, you know, when in person. I don't know. I think there's going to be a ton of things that are going to become way more normal than they ever were before. And yeah, in our sport, we're going to have a lot of that, I think.
The reality of it has not sunk in at all for me. I just can't believe that this is happening, even though it's been over 6 weeks at this point. But especially for you, you had some momentum, crazy momentum going before all this. You won the Australian Open, your first men's doubles Grand Slam title with Joe.
Yeah.
I mean, you were up to a career high number 5 in doubles. I mean, things were going swimmingly, I have to say. What was your start of 2020 like? Did you feel different going into the Australian Open? Because I know you put up an Instagram caption saying something like 58th time is the charm. Did you have anything else going for you differently this in Melbourne?
Well, I actually didn't even know that. So apparently it was my 58th Grand Slam, which is a record, if you want to call it that, before somebody were to actually win one. But I mean, that's a little bit different because I played a lot of the majors and doubles while I was still focusing on singles. So I didn't really felt like in those times I was necessarily a contender to win one. I was just sort of playing because my ranking was high enough to get in, but I was not, you know, I wasn't good enough just to win it, because I needed to actually work on, you know, focus on doubles, practice it, get better at it if I wanted to contend. And then only started doing that the last 3 years, I would say. But I really felt like we were in the situation or in the position to compete for a major regularly, probably at the US Open last year. I felt like our level had gotten to the point where we were playing good matches, you know, time and time again, at a level that I felt like was, you know, some of the best in the world. So I felt like we really turned the corner, you know, last fall, and we, you know, we had a good season altogether, but really at the back half of last year is when I felt like we started to play, you know, that a slightly higher level. So I'm not going to say I was, you know, I was expecting to win the Australian Open, but I guess I wasn't surprised so much so because I felt like we were at that point for a little while now, you know?
So when you say that you turned the corner in the fall, was there anything leading up to it that you did differently this time around? Or was it just the chemistry that changed?
We lost a really tough match at the US Open, 7-6 in the third. And it was just one of those matches, as you would know for sure, where you felt like, you know, you had to play just 3% better at the right time, maybe not even. And you know, that could have been not only that match, but it could have been the whole tournament, you know, because that's sort of the... You know, we felt like we were good enough to win the US Open last year, and we lost a really tough one. And we, you know, we had a, you know, sit down talk about what it's going to take, and just a bit more openness, a bit more, you know, what we're feeling on the court at the right time, a little more communication with each other. And we started really implementing that in the subsequent tournaments that we played in the fall, you know, in the European and Asian season. And it was like match after match, we didn't win everything, but it just felt like the level and that part of it was really getting better, so that we were getting through some more tougher situations. We were winning matches, maybe we weren't playing our best, and that started to happen a little bit more. So when we kind of turned up in Australia, it was like, you know, even if we weren't playing our absolute best, I felt like we were ready to win some of those matches. And when you try to win a big tournament over 2 weeks, that's what it's going to take, because I don't think you're not going to play well every day. Certainly you're going to have to fight through some stuff. And so that's sort of the big difference for me.
I know you won the mixed Grand Slam title in Australia as well in 2019, but did you feel different after this one? Like, as if maybe something was life different? Do you celebrate in a different way? Surely you did.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny. Life wasn't really that different, but it is somewhat of a life changing moment, I guess, in the way, like me personally. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you, it's not, because it was. I mean, I've tried to win one of these for a long time, and it's, you know, it's just cool to be a small part of tennis history in a way, because, you know, these are four of the four major tournaments, and to get my name on one of the trophies in the men's doubles is pretty neat. So I felt like it was almost like I felt a bit of relief, I guess, because I definitely felt like I was in the mix, but hadn't done it yet. And, you know, was really looking forward to the next few. Unfortunately, I don't know when that's going to happen, but, you know, it is in a way life-changing for me personally, just because I can say I did it, you know. No one's going to be able to take that away.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Hey guys, we're here with special guest Rajiv Ram, where he talks about what it takes to find that perfect partnership on the doubles court. Keep listening.
And what happens with the partnership, like with you and Joe? Do you guys talk? Are you guys planning on coming back together? I've never even thought about how teams might be affected by this. Literally, as you guys had decided to play together, you have to take a break.
Well, I mean, yeah, we actually talk a fair bit, once a week or something like that, and keep up on messaging anyway. But I mean, we played together all of the year before as well. So, you know, we were definitely more of an established partnership than maybe some of the other guys. So yeah, that's definitely not going to change. Now, I don't know about some of the other teams, so that's a good question. Some of the other players that may have had shorter commitments, or, you know, only going to play a couple of events together and then see what's happening. And yeah, it's actually a really good question. I don't know. I haven't heard about anybody not playing or playing together, but yeah, we definitely are. So whenever we start again.
What, I'm not sure if you would have known the answer to this, but I'm just curious, would you have had an idea as to who you would have been playing with in the Olympics had it happened this year?
You know, I was actually just starting to like call a few guys and see who would be interested, because the way that it works is if you're ranked in the top 10, you get to pick your partner. So like, I wouldn't have to have had somebody necessarily that qualified by ranking, you know, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a few players that I was just talking to, you know, seeing if maybe they weren't ranked high enough to go in singles or doubles, but I think they're great players. So if they were interested, so no, I didn't. The short answer is no, I didn't have an idea of who I was going to be playing with. I had a few people that I had in mind, but I didn't commit to anyone, or I hadn't made that decision. And I don't even know if it was going to be my decision entirely. I think there's probably, you know, a bit of the captain's input as well. But I literally just had one phone call with the captain of the team, with David Nankin, and then it all started going sideways for us. So,
and what about females for mixed?
Yeah, again, I had said it's a little bit of the same thing. You know, a few people, we had talked to a few people about playing, but I think, you know, I think in the Olympics in that situation, it's a bit of, you definitely have the input of the captains, both men and women. So I think it was going to be I know I was supposed to have some talks about it in Indian Wells and just say who is going to play, who is not going to play, and maybe even team up for some of the mixed doubles, like in the Grand Slams before the Olympics, just to see if, you know, one partnership worked out better than the other. But I mean, it obviously went away pretty fast after that, but no, nothing firm, you know.
Looking back, though, in Rio, you won a silver medal with Venus Williams. And now, I mean, you're 37. She's a few years older than you.
36.
My bad. 36. So you still have, I think you still have many years left, but you never know how this is all going to play out. Will Tokyo even happen next year? It's kind of thrown everything off a little bit. But you played with Venus Williams at the Olympics and medaled. That must have been one of the most incredible experiences for sure in your career.
Yeah, to be honest, just going to the Olympics at all was pretty amazing. I mean, when you're, you know, in tennis, I guess I, for one, never really thought about the Olympics. You think about the Grand Slams, think about some of their big tournaments, maybe even Davis Cup, Fed Cup, that kind of thing. But, you know, the Olympics, I always thought about as a sport, an event that people from other sports play. But then when, as a tennis player, when I got to be on the team and just be around that environment of such great athletes and ambassadors for different sports from all over the world, be part of the opening ceremonies. I mean, to be honest, the medal felt like icing on the cake a little bit. It was just the experience that I've got to be a part of that was just so incredible. And then, yeah, I mean, playing with the legend of the game, I mean, that sort of happened at the 11th hour when we were picking, you know, okay, the second year, I think, of mixed doubles. So people didn't really know how, you know, no one ever played together before. We just sort of said, okay, you know, again, the captains were like, I think we were the two people players that were going to get in, happened to pair up. And then we actually played another American team in the final. So it was pretty cool that worked out the way that it did. Unfortunately, we didn't win, but other than that, it was cool.
It was a close match. I know that Keenan was a tiebreaker, which is nuts to even to fathom the idea of being on court for a gold medal and playing a super tiebreaker is beyond insane.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you look for in a partner? Because and what do you think that your strengths are that you need somebody else's strengths to balance out? Because I know doubles is a bit of a matching game. You got to figure out who really works with you. What do you think you do best and what you want your partner to do best? You know, there's like finisher and setter upper and all kinds of like basics to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that I've learned, because like I said, I've kind of been really paying attention to this doubles, you know, primarily for the last few years, is that you really need to have someone who you feel like you can trust, you can be open with. Like that communication part has to be there first and foremost. Because I mean, like the best thing I can do, you know, on a doubles court is get my partner to play well. If he plays well, then it makes my job so much easier. I don't have to do much, you know? So it's like, if I can say the right thing to put him or her in a good state of mind to play their best tennis, I mean, it helps a lot. So before even you're talking about game compliment, I think that has to be there. You have to feel comfortable with, you know, personality wise. And then I think, you know, you try to look for someone who kind of compliments you. You may be things that you don't do so well, you know, they do well, and vice versa. So like, I mean, certainly not the fastest, most agile player out there. So I try to look for someone who's maybe a pretty good athlete to start with and can cover a bit more of the court that way. That's usually my first thought. I my strength is probably, you know, hitting the ball. Okay. So, you know, again, I try and see if the person at the, you know, who's at the net or my partner, that I can set them up because I hit the ball pretty well. So I can put it in difficult spots for the opponent and they can kind of clean up because of their athleticism and their agility and all that. So that's sort of it. And the other thing is I look for someone who serves pretty well. I serve pretty well too. So I feel like if two guys on the court serve well, you kind of take care of half of the games, then, you know, you can be a bit more expressive, let's say, on the return games. But to think holding serve is such a big part of men's doubles that if that goes away, it's pretty tough to win, you know?
Honestly, you make it sound so easy. I mean, like, listening to you, I was like, oh yeah, that sounds about right. That's how they want to slam.
I think people overcomplicate tennis sometimes, to be honest.
Yeah,
that's fair. That's absolutely fair. But you, I mean, we've talked doubles here. You've won 20 doubles titles, but you've also won two singles titles, notably mm-hmm. in a very particular venue, Newport, one of my favorite places in the world, on grass.
Mine too.
You mentioned serve. Yeah, I mean, something clearly worked for you there. It might have been the grass. How did you decide to take a step back from singles? Because you played in 2017, you played, I think, one mm-hmm. match or something in 2018, and now you're fully doubles.
Yeah, I did. That's right. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, no, it was really, I stopped really at the end of 20, or at the middle of 2017, actually at Newport. It was my last singles match. I felt like that was, you know, for me, it was good to do it that way. But it was really just my body. I mean, I felt like I couldn't put in the hours of training that singles required, some of the physical stuff that was, you know, needed for that. I just wasn't gonna be able to do it. I had a few injuries that kept nagging, and I just felt like, you know, I was sort of, if I kept playing singles, I was gonna do neither singles or doubles to my best capacity. So it was, the decision was kind of staring me in the face for a little while, and I just finally decided to pull the plug. That summer, I felt like I was in a good situation with my doubles, had a good partner. At the time, it was a guy named Raven Clausen. So it wasn't Joe, it was another player, but we did pretty well the year before, finished, I think, top eight in the world. So, you know, I was, everything was leaning towards that. And I just, it was definitely time, because I just knew I couldn't put in the work that was required to play singles at my highest level.
So obviously when you play singles, you have to cover a little bit more court than in the doubles.
Slightly.
So for someone that's, you know, doesn't really know tennis, what would you say would be the differences between someone that is a singles and doubles player and just someone that is strictly doubles? What would you say is the difference in, you know, time on court, time in gym? What would you say are like the key components or the decrease in time?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think for sure time on court is significantly higher. That's actually one of the things I had to struggle with when I started just playing doubles, is how many fewer matches I would play and how many fewer like repetitions I'd get under pressure situations, because I just was used to playing so much in both, you know, in a tournament I would always play both singles and doubles, so it would generally be at least three or four matches each week. And in doubles, sometimes you can, you know, lose a third set tiebreaker in an hour and then you don't play again for a week and a half. So it was really a big change for me in that situation. I think, you know, I commend the guys that do both at a high level, and the girls, because I just feel like it's a lot of stress mentally, physically. You have to be ready. You have to be able to, you know, kind of compete, be ready to compete every day, day in and day out, and, you know, figure out your schedule. Maybe you play some tournaments just for singles, just for doubles, whatever it is. So you end up adding weeks to the schedule. It's more travel. It's just more of everything. And I think that was another reason in 2016, I played over 100 matches in singles and doubles. And I felt like if I had another one of those years, that might've been it for my career. You know, I might've just have run my body into the ground. So I just felt like, you know, that toll wasn't something I was going to be able to take on anymore. So like the guys and girls that do this for many, many years, it's really, really impressive.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast with special guest Rajiv Ram. He's telling us about his 2016 Olympic experience with Venus Williams when they won the silver medal. Keep listening.
You talk about how physically it's taxing and it's total, mm-hmm. it's a lot for the body. Mentally, were there any changes that you had to go through or that you experienced going from singles and doubles to just doubles? I've always found, just from a personal experience, when I play doubles, there's just a certain sense of pressure that I just get because I want to, you know, I want to win so bad for my partner.
For your partner, yeah.
And so if I play with someone that is there just for doubles, like my pressure just goes way high. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Completely. There was a big change in mindset, because when you're playing singles, you win, it's for you, you lose, it's for you. And it's a lot easier to deal with sometimes than, you know, the fact that you're kind of half responsible for somebody else's livelihood, especially, like you said, if they're only a doubles player, if they don't play singles. So yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that it was tougher for me to sort of play some of my best tennis, because I felt like I had the pressure of, you know, not wanting to disappoint my partner. But I think that's where the communication kind of aspect comes into play. I mean, I was lucky enough to play in these partnerships where we weren't just playing for a week or two, like they were year long commitments. So like, you can be like, hey, look, I'm not feeling so well today. This is bothering me. And then like that person will likely understand what you're thinking, because they're also in the same situation. So, you know, I think that's where it's important just to not sit there and feel that pressure and bottle it up and not, you know, try and deal with it with your partner, however you might be, because then I think that doesn't really help. It doesn't really make things easier, you know? So I think that was a big thing, is just saying, you know, because if it's singles and you're not feeling good, well, that day, it doesn't matter if you tell somebody else or not, you're going to have to figure it out yourself on the court. So I wasn't really used to doing that. And that was a big change for me, that, you know, if I'm not feeling something, I could actually tell my partner instead of keeping it inside and trying to figure it out by myself, because it's only going to help our team, you know, and same with him.
Communication is the key to everything.
Yeah, I guess so. It's like talking about a marriage, really, isn't it? At the end of the day.
I was going to say, it sounds like you're picking a partner for life here.
A little bit, yeah. Funny how that was.
On kind of a similar note, in a way, what do you feel like when people say they're playing doubles just for fun? And when you definitely would have noticed a difference in terms of like prize money, attention, fans, everything, when you switched from singles to doubles. Does that weigh on you? Because I think doubles has made a massive amount of progress. I'm sure you've seen it over your career, but it still feels like the little sister to the big dogs.
Yeah. And I mean, to be honest, I think in a way it is a little bit. I mean, I understand the position that doubles is in. I can't really say that I have an issue if somebody plays doubles just for fun. I have an issue if they don't really try very hard. Like, that's a problem. I think that, you know, if somebody goes out on the doubles court and doesn't give it, you know, doesn't really try and win, however that may be, you know, if they literally go out there to not win, that's a problem. But I think it's a bit of a gray area. I think, like you said, I think doubles players, their doubles in general has made some progress. I think we also have to take some of the responsibility as doubles players to promote the game and promote what we do ourselves. And I think the guys on our side, I can't speak for the WTA Tour because I don't know as well. I'm not saying they don't. But for us, I feel like the current group of players has really done a nice job, led by the Bryans that have done it for so long so well, in trying to be innovative and trying to come up with things that help the game and not just help themselves, you know? Yeah, I think we struggle sometimes because we are sort of the little brother or little sister of the tour, that we're sort of always trying to just get that extra little bit for ourselves, as opposed to maybe banding together and coming up with a situation maybe that could make our product a bit more attractive. And I think the guys currently, not everything has worked, but at least we've tried to make those improvements and do some things. You know, for example, we've had like a doubles court in Australia and a few other places where like the whole day, is doubles matches. We've had, different clinics that we put on. We've talked about different scoring systems. We've talked about, having fans have free movement in doubles matches, different things like this, that they're not all going to work. They're not even going to be tried, but at least we're coming up with ideas that I think could make it a bit unique.
I mean, you've played world team tennis and you've played the ATP Cup, so you have a sense of experience when it comes to things being changed up in tennis for the better.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I think one of the big issues in tennis in general for us is we don't look at it from the perspective of the fan. We always look at it as in the perspective of the players and the coaches and the, tournament directors and all this. But what about the person that's paying $50 or whatever it is to buy a grounds ticket to come and watch us play? Like, what about their experience? And I think if we think about it from that perspective a bit more, we can really help ourselves. So that was sort of the idea that I remember when I don't think I was on the council, but was still talking with the guys a bit about the stuff, was having the free movement. It's like you come and, you catch it's 0-0 and you're sitting there, and for a doubles match, you got to wait three whole games before you can walk inside because somebody, they don't let you in at 1-0. And then they, that seems ridiculous. So like I would get disinterested in about 30 seconds and I would go to the next court, And it's like, if I knew I could walk into a doubles court whenever I wanted, I would be way more likely to do that.
I'm surprised you actually say that, because I mean, you don't think that you'd be affected whatsoever if, a bunch of people just keep coming in, if it's like a deuce point, important point.
I totally think I'd be affected, but I also feel like that's sort of the give and take of it, right? Like, we don't think of it. So I'm being affected by it, sure. But if I know it's going to happen, I think it's almost worse if you think it shouldn't happen and then it happens. But if you know it could happen or it's going to happen, why not try and make the experience for the fan a little bit better than having them stand, in line to wait for you to serve a deuce point when, okay, maybe they can't come in, on the backs of the court, but maybe they can come in on the sides. Maybe they can at least, maybe they're not going to go to their seat, but they can stand and watch in a certain area, something to where it's just a little bit better than what it is right now. And I think for me, it always bothers me when I know they're not supposed to come in and then they come in. But if I know that it's okay for them to do that, then I would probably be a bit less bothered by it.
I feel like you put a lot of thought into this. Do you have any plans on what you want to do after your career and how you're going to stay involved in tennis? Sounds like you definitely will be.
Yeah. I mean, I know that traveling would be hard. So like the idea of coaching full-time on tour or doing something like that, that's tricky. But I love the sport. Look, I'm lucky to do what I love for a living. So I think being involved in some way would be great. I don't really have a grand plan as to what that would be, but I do really enjoy it at all levels, not even just the professional level. I love my time in college and high school tennis and all that. It's just, I think it's given me a lot. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. The college tennis thing, 1 year at Illinois and you crushed it. Your team went 32-0. You won the NCAA team title, NCAA doubles title. And then you were like, peace out, guys. Gotta go pro.
Yeah, to be honest, if I could do it again, I would have stayed another year at least. At the time, it was 2003, and like players were retiring when they were 30. If you played past 30, it was an absolute miracle. So I thought, geez, I was 19. If I turned pro, then it would be, okay, I'd be 19. I'd probably have 10, 11 good years to try and, play. That was my thought process. I'm like, yeah, this is going to be over and I'm 30, so I might as well. We had a great season. I probably knew that I wasn't fully ready or as ready as I could be, but I kind of took my chances because, the fact that we did have a great year and I felt like, I wanted to give it my best shot. Now, I mean, you have players playing their best tennis in their mid 30s, in singles and doubles both. So it's like, if I had known that, or if I had had a little bit of foresight, if you will, I would have stayed another year, because I think college tennis could have really helped my game even a bit more, and just general maturity and all that. I would have been well served to stay another year in school, but, that was sort of what happened at that time.
Could you see yourself like as a college coach?
I could absolutely see myself as a college coach. I think it's one of the best sort of ways that we have, the best sort of formats that we have in tennis. Six players of that age playing for their school, singles and doubles, the whole thing. I think it's fantastic. So I think if the right opportunity came along, I would be very interested in that at some point.
And fun fact, Indiana University graduate, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Indiana University East, but yeah.
Yeah,
you too?
Yeah, we're both Indiana University grads. Yeah,
that's right. I didn't know that.
And I remember you were telling me how because the ATP and the WTA, they pay for a percentage of the tuition if you make a C or better. I remember you were telling me that because you also got in-state tuition, I think you were paying like $17 a semester or something.
Because I'm actually an Indiana resident, it helped me out because I couldn't believe it when I saw the school that the tours are working with is actually like an hour away from where I grew up and in my state. So I got the discount, I got the in-state tuition. So it was like, if I don't do this now, I'm never going to do it.
Did you walk down? Did you have the graduation, the whole thing?
Actually, sort of. I graduated in December. So like in the
same
middle, right? But they were unbelievable. I happened to be home at the time. I drove over. They gave me a cap and gown. Like 20 people from the faculty, including my advisor, came. Like they made like a little cake and cookies. Like they gave me a tour of the campus. It was so lovely. They put this whole ceremony together just for me, which I thought was so cool because I was, nobody else was graduating, or I guess anyone else that was graduating, that was there was only going to be there in May or whatever. So yeah, they put like this whole thing together and it was really nice actually.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
You made a really casual point here that you grew up in Indiana. It's kind of a rare, not really a hot spot in tennis. Mm. You used to have a pro tournament. I know it doesn't now. That didn't have plans for some kind of challengers to come back there. But how did you figure out tennis as a pathway to college and pro and all that from such a small town in Indiana?
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky actually. The time that I was growing up there, we had a bunch of players that were either my age or slightly older that played really high level Division I tennis, and some of them even played professionally to a certain extent. So I grew up around a lot of good players, which helped me a lot. So it wasn't really like the, small town with nobody there that knew how to hit the ball back and forth. Like I had quite a few, our high school tennis at the time, a bunch of guys played really high level Division I tennis that we played, that we played against in the same time. So that's part of it. But it's still obviously not Florida. It's not, Southern California, where it's just like, great tennis players around every corner. So I think in a way it helped me a little bit. It kept tennis normal. It kept tennis as more of a hobby until I got to the point where I was thinking about a professional career. I think if I had played, at a super intense level as a 13, 14 year old, I think I would have been, there was a chance I could have gotten burnt out by it. Cause it was like tennis was just something I did on the side. I still went to normal school. I never did anything. I never went anywhere. I never went to a tennis academy, and I never really had any interest in doing that. So I think in a way it actually kind of helped me to come from a place that it wasn't all I thought about all the time.
Did you have a backup plan? Like if things hadn't worked out and you weren't going to go pro in tennis, what was your career plan going to be?
That's a good question. I don't know if I had a backup plan, but I definitely was going to go to college and go that route. Even if it wasn't going to be a professional career, I loved the sport. So whether it was going to be doing something with it in some capacity, I think I would have been involved in the game. I don't exactly know how, but I didn't really have a for sure backup plan, but I think it would have been involved with tennis in some way.
And you're also involved now with your neighborhood or your community. You have Entourage for Kids. Entourage?
Mm-hmm. Entourage, yeah. Entourage?
Play on words. I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, that actually came up. I played at that tournament in Indianapolis that you were talking about 1 year. I played Sam Querrey in the second or third round, I can't remember. And he had a group of his buddies traveling around that summer called the Samurai. And so my friends decided they had to come up with something to compete against that. And that was how it worked out.
Very clever.
I like it. And what's the purpose of the charity now? Is it just to get kids involved, particularly in tennis? What's the goal?
Yeah, so the main thing for me, like I said, I think tennis is such a great pathway to making better decisions for kids that may not have the opportunity to do that. So we try and give grants and fund high school tennis programs in Indianapolis that, are in need. So they don't have proper courts, they don't have rackets, they don't have nets, balls, whatever. So they can apply for grants through our foundation and, we give them money to basically purchase those things to hold and have a high school tennis team to where a kid maybe who's interested in tennis could have somewhere to go, at the end of the day and be on a tennis team as opposed to maybe doing something else. So that's one facet of it. Another facet, we have a high performance grant that we give through the Midwest section, which is the section, the USTA section that it's in. So of a player in Indiana that's shown high level of skill and, you know, needs money for traveling to tournaments and basically further their tennis career. I received that grant when I was a kid in the Midwest. So it just felt like, you know, it was an important thing for my family. Tennis is not a cheap sport, especially when you don't make any money doing it when you're a kid, you know, trying to, you know, get better at it. So just something that I felt like was a really useful thing that I actually remember receiving that grant. So I just wanted to basically give another one of those to somebody from the state.
Oh, that's awesome.
I have one final question here. I've noticed, I'm sure you've heard this a billion times, that your strokes in a way look like Pete Sampras's. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I want to know if you've ever met with him, played with him. What's your relationship like with Pete? Because he would have been definitely a few years ahead of you.
Yeah. So I never was I shouldn't say never. I mean, I played a couple of US Opens when I was a kid, when he was still playing, but I didn't turn pro until he retired. I turned pro in 2004 and he retired, I guess, in 2002 or three. But yeah, so I have played with him a few times and it's obviously come up. I mean, it's hard not to have had it come up. He's been very nice about it. I don't have a relationship with him. It's not like we're buddies or anything, but like I have hit with him on occasion. And like the second time I hit with him, he knew I was about to hit with him, and he's called me his twin, which any comparison I'll take.
Wow.
You know, absolutely.
I'll take
that.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't really have a coach growing up. I learned by watching. I guess I have a bit of a knack for that, but I just I thought he was awfully good, and why not try to be like the best player in the world at the time when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and it just sort of stuck. It just sort of became how I played the game. But yeah, I've definitely heard that before.
It's definitely worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, to a certain extent, not quite as well as it worked for him. But
oh man,
that's awesome. All right, well, let's end on that note. I really enjoyed speaking with you. I mean, we definitely covered a lot of topics here, but it's been a blast, Regime. Thank you for your time and the Tennis Podcast.
Thank you guys for what you do, for sure. It's great. Any promotion of the game is awesome, so we really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rajiv. Take care of yourself.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
From the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, this has been the Tennis.com Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay caught up. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, as well as tennis.com/podcasts. You can also see the videos of our episodes on Tennis Channel's YouTube page and Tennis.com's Facebook page. We're your hosts, Nina Pantic and Irina Falcone. We'd like to thank our team, editor and audio designer and video editor Christina Koseva, producers Alexa March and Sean O'Malley, and executive producers Shelby Coleman, Kyle Einhorn, and Andy Chu.